When the practice grows stale, last spring, I mean, a couple of months ago, I gave myself permission not to meditate daily anymore for a while, right? And it came from a feeling that it was routine and rote and somewhat forced, when I did sitting in the morning. And it didn't come from the heart. And then it turned out that some days I did a sitting in the afternoon instead because I felt ready for it. And I still haven't quite returned to the regular daily morning and so forth. I want the meditation to have a heart connection, not just a hygiene thing where for my mental health, which is very, I mean, for which it is very good. But anyway, that's sort of the question comment.
I don't know. I mean, we are, of course, all different, and not. I mean, there's not kind of a recipe that I feel very confident that should apply to everybody, or that would work for everybody. And also, the way we motivate us, what motivates us, the way we it's surprisingly different from person to person. You think like in a meditation hall, everybody's doing the same thing, and then sometimes like when I teaching retreats and you go to the interviews and you realize, wow, what's going on for the individual people is so different, just totally different worlds. And it changes all the time, as you find out. And so I certainly would always approve of that, to say usually in general. So now I couldn't confidently say that's necessarily true for everybody all the time, but it's certainly, I think it's not a bad thing. If you start to feel that your motivation is going, or like you're saying, like it's feeling like stale, you're not sure anymore why you're meditating, or you feel you know why you're meditating, but you don't really like those reasons. Like, say, well, I'm just then. I think it could be a good idea. I mean, I would suggest that and just stop meditating. As it does make quite a lot of difference. So there's, of course, a certain risk. You might lose some people, stop meditating, and they start to do other things, and 20 years later, oops, what happened? I can ultimately, I can only talk for myself or for my practice. As far as I trust my motivation for spiritual practice, that goes beyond meditation. Of course, meditation is a very, very central part of that, or has become that. But the kind of spiritual quest. And we have different, well, there's probably only a certain range, but sometimes we have slightly different fundamental questions that drive us in life on our spiritual quests. And it is good to know those, and sometimes to remember or try to remember. They can also change, of course. One's own spiritual biography, as it were. How did I get into this? What were the things that actually, but I feel at least, as far as I can know, they pushed me into that. What are my questions? And so, and how do I try to pursue them? And then meditation, I would agree, is always can be a very important part of them. But it's not the thing that is necessarily fix everything for you if you just dutifully just do your hygiene every day. I mean, sometimes there are surprises and we get things that we don't know where they came from, and certainly don't feel you deserve them. But so some part is also what you get out of your practices, what you put into them, what you put into it in terms of the motivation, the questions that you have, what you're looking for. And that if it's all just in the end just become just mental hygiene, then that's what you get. If you're lucky, if it works well enough, that's not bad. That's of course a good thing, but. Like it might not be enough. You say you feel there's something or something that's gone missing that was there before. So I trust in the kind of thing, if I have somehow faith in the connection of my basic, let's call it spiritual search, if that is still alive, I mean, if that's dead, then I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, it doesn't matter what I say then, I mean, but if that's still alive, It doesn't have to be bound to any particular kind of exercise. I mean, I think that would be, in the wider sense, one of the cases of what the Buddha called Silabhata Paramasa, no? Attachment to rites and rituals. I have to do my meditation. No? I have to do this technique. If I don't do this technique, then I'm going to miss it, or whatever. Invited to experiment, to explore. And this particular question, again, talking around the pudding, as it were, but it's like, I mean, just stop meditating and see what happens. And maybe at some point you'll find there's something missing, right? And you think, well, what is it? Well, maybe it's meditation. And then you want to meditate, and then suddenly you know where your motivation comes from. If you suddenly really are, you suddenly really want to meditate again, and it might be in a different way. Maybe it's not, like you said, maybe it's not the morning. Maybe suddenly you start to meditate at a different time, or even in a different way. I don't really believe in, from the motivational point of view, like in doing it out of a sense of duty. Otherwise I'm not, I'm not living up to my standards. I'm not a good Buddhist or meditator or person or whatever. That is that question that we need to keep alive. Why do I meditate? What do I actually get out of it? Do I get anything out of it? And if I suddenly feel, no, I mean, I'm just seem to be wasting my time here. Probably you don't, but then, well, okay, what else do you want to do? What do you really want to do? Well, do that. Hopefully it's not too wild a thing. I think what's more important, I mean, is the five precepts. There's a rationality behind it, of course. I mean, you can also believe it or don't believe it. I have great faith in that, and that those five precepts and the morality that encodes, they are there for many reasons, but for very good reasons. They give us a framework to orient how to live our lives. But for a very, very long time ago, I once heard this one spiritual teacher. I mean, he wasn't a Buddhist, and but mentioned this kind of thing. He was talking about he was saying there was only two really kind of important questions or spiritual questions in life. And that was his way of putting it. And he was saying the one is like, in his language, who am I? Which is basically the wisdom question is, what is all this about? This strange thing we call reality that we seem to be sharing with all these people. Supposedly, it's kind of somehow similar than me. But what is this about? You want to find out. We don't want to just live that life unconsciously, isn't it? And there might be more urge behind it, a sense of unsatisfaction, suffering, all that, what the Buddha picked up, of course. But then there's also this interesting, there's a second one, which is very important, is how am I supposed to live my life? No, I suppose not you guys who are here, certainly not the monks, because otherwise they obviously have asked themselves the questions, otherwise they wouldn't be here. But you probably also have. But some people miss out on that, isn't it? They just think, oh yeah, I want to have the spiritual truth, the want to find out the true nature of the universe. And for this, I need sophisticated or simple spiritual practices, but I need to do my practice. I might start off, as I did, looking at books, but I just end up giving you a headache. And then you say, you need something practical. So you start to meditate and think you're going to find out something. Maybe you do, or maybe not, or maybe it's the questions go on. But from certainly also not from the Buddha's point of view, or many spiritual teachers' point of views, and that's not enough. There's a second part. It has to translate, of course. Well, of course, according to my view at least, into more than just this it formal spiritual practice. It's about how we live our life. Because in the Buddhist project, of course, the whole thing is about understanding the nature of suffering and understanding that it's not that. It's optional in the end. It's something that we create. There's a way out of it through it, which is through understanding. But that understanding, well, as we often use say in our words, it needs to be a realization. It's of course not an intellectual understanding, and that needs to be lived. It's almost like with anything really that we learn, even with practical skills, isn't it? If you learn a practical skill, but then you never use it, it just turns into a memory, isn't it? It's maybe not necessarily, it depends, no? It's not necessarily entirely true. There's many things, right? If you either you use it or lose it, isn't it? So, and I think we can have that experience sometimes. People have that also with practice, often when they're younger, they've done a lot of retreats and then also had these wonderful experiences. but maybe you've missed out on how to allow those insights to inform what you're actually doing with your life, how you live your life, not from our basic motivations, intentions, how we treat ourselves, how we treat other people, how we treat the planet. If those things don't go together, and in the Buddhist language, one could talk about the same thing, I guess, in Christian language and language in other religions, a Buddhist language, about dukkha, if we feel it's about understanding dukkha, so that we do not create unnecessary suffering for ourselves, then how is that going to work if we keep creating unnecessary suffering in our life for ourselves and others? It obviously has to somehow come together. It has to be that's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path and not just meditation, isn't it? I mean, in a way, hopefully I state the obvious. And it's like, I mean, like the Buddha just recognized, isn't it? It's like the Buddha himself, that he usually his gradual teachings, he would start like before the five precepts, before he would go on to the five precepts, as the meditation would usually come down quite a bit further down the line. Before that, he would usually always teach the five precepts, and always depending on where people are at, he would pick, people up. And then, but the first thing that he would always teach would be generosity. Because he realized that generosity is a kind of a natural quality of the human heart, which is perhaps the most easily accessible for us, which helps us to open the heart and connect other people and get out of this obsessive, well, the self-obsession, isn't it, which the Buddha identified as the root of our unnecessary suffering. And I guess we have all noticed that in our life, how effective it can be. I mean, if it's lacking wisdom, of course, it also maybe doesn't go ultimately that far. But as I mean, we can sit 200 hours on the meditation cushion and maybe either just be dozing away and feeling somewhat peaceful, or busily reflect on life and suffering and the Buddhist teaching and da-da-da-da. And if you're well, in the end, so what? If you just go around in circles, and you might have one moment of where you share something really from the heart and generously, and suddenly, wow, the heart opens up and you start to experience like a totally different reality. Well, suddenly you don't feel as isolated and suffering and as before. And just a simple gesture. So there's so much, to spiritual practice, that meditation is, I think, a very useful and very powerful tool, and one that, really kind of, a very important ingredient, the royal way kind of down, to the core of things, if you want to develop insight. But it's natural as well, I think. I mean, we all have different, come with different, we have a different past, we have a different baggage that we have to work through, also psychological baggage and who knows, karmic stuff. We have different resources as well that we think, and part of the practice is developing resources, different resources, so that the heart becomes lighter, more resourced, and have more things that you can actually use for your inner well-being, so that you are less dependent on external kind of sources of well-being. But so the path of this meditation is different for everybody, but I think it's common enough, so it certainly changes, and that there are periods where partner, we feel like we're not getting anywhere, or we feel not motivated, or it doesn't suddenly feel, well, how did I get here? Or hang on about, well, what am I actually doing, or why am I doing it? And yeah, I think it's a good wake-up call. I mean, that's obviously, the eternal wonder of awareness, isn't it? The moment you're talking about it means you're already noticing. That's a power of awareness. And that's already, you've got at least a toe out of the water, as it were, or out of the swamp, and saying, okay, it doesn't feel quite right, so I'm motivated to do something about it. There's your motivation.
Yeah.
And then you can be creative, just do something else. And I think it's perfectly fine sometimes. Give yourself permission to never meditate again. Don't say, oh, just for a while. Maybe it's safer, just say, have a holiday and see what happens. But I don't trust this kind of thing about them, and I think I have to meditate because I'm supposed to meditate. I mean, who says that? I mean, not even the Buddha says that you have to meditate. He just said it might be quite a useful tool. It might not even be useful for everybody, and certainly not all the time. So, but I think what's more important see love, five precepts, generosity, good qualities, developing all that, you know, attitude, this to not just to my meditation, but to life and everything. And in terms of developing this thing, is to keep alive the questioning attitudes that we have. As that is just remembering our original motivation, the big questions was, what are they actually? Are they still alive? Also, like, what is actually now really relevant for me to really and question, being willing to question anything. That's what makes the mind a very sharp tool. I mean, we should be able to question anything so that you find out what really are our priorities right now. So then, only then I can really find out what really is my motivation, what does inspire me. That's not a problem. I don't think there's any problem.
No, that's. I mean, I'm pretty confident that, you know, there'll be a return to the daily practice because it just is such a rich resource. But what I was trying to do is opening the heart and looking for more energy to come in. And I think your point about generosity is very, very crucial because I do a lot of head work and that's not warming the heart.
Yeah, well, and that's what I mean by questioning. I mean, really, like questioning the heart and questioning from the heart.
Yeah.
You see, because notice how even that is like, I mean, it's very understandable, but that's how the conditioned mind works and the conditioned and conditioning mind in which we are kind of trapped, isn't it? We have suppositions. We presuppose that it should be in a certain kind of way. We judge. I mean, that's what our mind is built like. It's, and it has its uses, its good side. But that's also the cage that it builds for us, that the Buddha pointed out. We are compulsively judging everything. We have to, otherwise, in order to get some orientation, you know. But that's why I'm saying we need to be able to question everything out from the heart. Then our search is alive. Even that's like even the thought that, yeah, I'm confident that at some point I will go back to this meditation because it's a good resource. It's okay, but if you examine it, you really, again, this is just also a presupposition, as you call it, like that, of the mind based on what we are familiar with and what we think we know and what gives us some security, but which at the same time might deaden us. You know, I said, oh, yeah, well, I mean, actually, maybe I should stop this for a while because, you know, really motivating to try something else. Well, I'm sure I'm going to go, well, maybe not, but you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, the weirdest things happen to people in a good or bad way. But, you know, but just to know that, I mean, that is practice, the direct looking. No, I mean, it's not that it's by itself, it's wrong, but you notice, okay, that's an assumption that I'm making. And that's based on the habit forming mind that's precisely. To me, I mean, so that's the source of identification, which also becomes like the cage that we attracted that we want to get out of. And that, know, reality is always here. It's an open invitation all the time, isn't it? But we have plans about what we should be doing about it and how I should organize my practice it can, of course, be supportive and take us to a certain point, but we have to be willing to actually. Question it means that gives us the possibility to see it for what it is, to see personality for what it is. It's nothing wrong with it. It becomes wrong if you're trapped in it. If you really identify with it, then that's where we're stuck, isn't it? And that's also why I'm saying like we are all so different and not necessarily the same advice of will not help for everybody because mainly because of the powerful ways in which we are conditioned and in which we also will hear advice and apply because we are so compulsive really in our personal traits that it's very difficult to get out of it and we just keep trying to do things in the same way, you know, like banging like a fly, you know, trying to get out of the window, bang bang bang. And there you can see the basic nature of the mind, but it's ours is much more sophisticated, but it's based on similar principles, isn't it? But we have access to this wonderful conscious access to this wonderful resource, the ultimate resource, which is the heart awareness, which means we can see it. We can see all of it. You know? We can see our enthusiastic motivation when we feel we are just around the corner from enlightenment, like when I was young. And we can see the stale feeling about, oh well, you know, this is obviously not really for me. I mean, I might just keep playing the act, so I'm at least a half decent person, and but you know, nothing's ever happening. But that's all the way we interpret our experience already from our mind. That's the stories that we tell ourselves. And what we need to use awareness was to see the stories as stories. Then you're meditating all the time. You don't have to sit down in the morning, in the afternoon. And that, literally, I mean, that's, and it does happen any moment.
Are you able to switch from heart awareness to mind awareness just like this?
Well, what's the difference? Is it different?
Maybe for you it's not.
Well, I mean, it's division. So many. It's just that there's a concept. You know, I'm not saying that's not useful, but I might have. But you say in the Buddhist, in Eastern cultures, they really have one word usually for heart and mind. You know, in Western thinking, you have actually usually traditionally divided it. So these days, that's been questioned, of course, a lot as well. You know, but basically, there's consciousness, and of course, in the Buddha's language, you know, and in our tradition, of course, it talks about the different kinds of sense consciousness and all kind of that. But the base of it is like mind consciousness, but that it's not that there's a mind consciousness and heart consciousness, it's consciousness. And those, that consciousness, like say, like your consciousness, as in, you know, I'm not saying I understand it all, but it's a kind of individual manifestation, you know, in a human being, it's a conscious being process. It just has both of those aspects. It has the cognitive aspect. You could call the mind consciousness, you know. And the other thing is more like the feeling aspect, the affective qualities of the heart. But it's the same consciousness. And the Buddha was always talking about like consciousness and what he called vedana, which is often translated as feeling, and sanya, which is what we usually translate as perception. They always go together. You can't have one without the other. You know, there's only one sort of state of mind where they fall apart, but we don't need to talk about that. I mean, anything that's usually accessible for us, you always, if you're conscious, you always have perception and you always have feeling. It means your experience always has a feeling tone. It always feels somehow, you know? And you always perceive it as something. And I think that's a basic building block of what we would call like maybe the cognitive aspect of the mind, where you might call it mind consciousness, and the affective consciousness of the mind, you might call it the heart consciousness. But it's only one consciousness. You know? So switch, I don't know. I think ideally they always both operate together because they support each other. If you only got one without the other, it's pretty unbalanced, I think. So rather than switching wildly back and forth, if you've got both alive, it means you should be intelligent in a cognitive sense, smart, understanding things, but also your heart is open. So that your understanding is not sterile or cynical, can become cynical even otherwise. Yeah, I don't even like, I mean, talk about it as mind and heart consciousness, but just notice whether your heart is open or not. That's one of the interesting spiritual inquiries, which are valid anytime, not just when you sit in your cushion. You know, what's actually the state of my heart? And we notice that mostly, of course, the interaction with other people, that's where more suffering arises, isn't it? And I think that's part of our natural practice. If you suddenly realize that's mindfulness practice, which we prepare for in formal meditation, so that ideally it starts to, how do you call it, spill over, isn't it, and into our daily life, that we just start to notice it more. And that you become more conscious. It means you notice more things going on, not just cognitively, always cognitively, because it's perception, but also in an effective way. You notice how things affect you, how that changes your moods, and how that changes the way you respond to people. And you don't need to switch. I think it comes more from consciously investing in your practice and paying attention to that. Just pay attention to your heart. And if you get too lost, just in heart stuff, and it just pulls you all over the place, making perspective, then well, you maybe need to invest a bit more also in the more perceptive abilities of the mind to discernment, you might say, you know, to discern also more from a more mental kind of way. But I think it's a sad saying also that the traditionally in Western culture, for such a long time, they have been separated so much. There's a lot of effort being done now also in science, of course, to bring them together again, to realize that one doesn't actually work with the other. You know? We can't actually be fully cognitively intelligent without having your heart switch on, because you need to know what you want. That's a heart, which that's a feeling that doesn't come from thinking. But weirdly enough, in the West, for a long time, we have thought that many people still think comes from thinking. If you just think hard enough about it, you find out. And you're just completely missing that the decision is made in the heart. It depends on what you feel is right, what you want to do. Then the mind then afterwards comes in and gives the reasons. And of course, the more intelligent your mind, you better, the more reasons you come up with. But the commitment is and has to come from the heart. If there's no motivation, you're not going to do anything about it, isn't it? You just go away and endlessly on. And that's, I think, sometimes where you get people who are a lot lost in doubt. Often people who are not necessarily always the case, but people who are too much too one-sidedly rationalist, or somehow certainly confused about their rationality, or just trying to think things out without actually being properly in touch with their heart. You know, even very intellectual, very apparently just rational intellectual tasks. I mean, you're only going to do them if you want to do it, isn't it? If you're motivated. Now, that's a feeling thing. That's not, if it doesn't have the feeling thing, the thought doesn't mean anything. Of course, all been shown by now with people who have, you know, if you have certain types of brain damage and or problems, you know, from whatever, like something going wrong in your brain, like just let's the apparatus, like say the physical kind of apparatus of our mind, you know, the parts of it which are responsible for processing, say, feeling, you know, if there are, you know, people who are not able to actually feel properly, so they are not able to function in daily life, this very basic tasks, because they can't prioritize. They understand everything rationally. They can tick all the right boxes in a test, say, well, what the right things to do. But they don't have any motivation. So in a real situation, it doesn't make any difference whether to them whether they do it or they don't do it. So it doesn't work. We can easily, but certainly in such an intellectual culture, intellectualized culture as we have, particularly in the West, so we can lose sight of that. But the heart is always there. You know? Heart consciousness is the basis of it all. You just need to, it's good to be in touch with things and be interested in that. Listen to your heart, listen to your intuitions, listen to your feelings. I mean, that's probably more for men, the thing mostly. I don't know, stereotype, but it's probably true. There's often more men who have problems with them. They just don't feel anything. They just try to think everything out. But, anything else? Yes. Well, yeah. So what to do with pain, like in daily activity and also meditation? I mean, in a way, same thing, isn't it? You're already opening up the chapter, which is basically taking interest in it. Like you're saying, the pain immediately, the mind, the attention immediately goes to the pain, does it? Yeah, I mean, maybe that's what it does. So that's, if that's my experience, it means already I have something, me has observed that, isn't it? So I found out something about pain. So what the Buddha said, pain needs to be investigated. We need to understand it. No? If not, we're always going to be victims to it. And that's the thing with suffering in general. Now, the interesting thing with pain is it makes it in a way very easy, very direct. You know, emotional suffering can be very complex and subtle and confusing relationships and you know, the kind of state of the world. But physical pain is usually pretty straightforward for most of us, in most cases. You know, a bit like you're saying, you know, it just, we don't want it. It hurts. We don't want it. Then we might have different strategies about how to deal with it at different times. But in terms of just looking at it and finding out, it's usually pretty direct. You know, it affects our mood. And then we can find out also about our personality, different strategies, you know, or whether we just try to deny it, we try to ignore it, we try to distract ourselves, have a lot of ice cream, or we just sulk and feel like sad for ourselves, and you know, why me? Or you know, you just see how all the personality evolves around pain. The basic thing around it is that hardly any of us, of course, will like it. We all have an aversion to pain. Well, and of course, it's important to examine. If you want to get if you don't want to create unnecessary suffering around pain, because pain itself, physical pain, just talking about physical pain, is inevitable. No, we always know that, and we have a body, we're gonna encounter physical pain. You know, my body supposedly is dying. I don't know when, but fairly soon, maybe or maybe not, if I'm lucky. And it's often painful, you know, and it's probably gonna get more painful. I'm looking forward to the morphine when I need it. We all go down the same way at some point. And whatever pains we have yet, as when we walk around the monastery and feel a bit old, aches a bit here and there, if you look at it, of course, we can probably be quite grateful that it's just that, because we know it's gonna get worse at some point. You know, I don't want to freak you out, but we all know. And of course, you don't want to walk around all the time saying, "Oh God, all the horrible things that are going to happen to me." That'd be very neurotic, isn't it? But we do know, you know, at some point we're going to die. And before that, we might have some terrible diseases, or we might have accidents. You know, God, some of my friends who, you know, a friend who recently broke a leg, if he just tells me about how it happened, I'm in agony. Just the horrible things that can happen to human bodies. And who wants it? I don't. I mean, I'm going to the dentist, goodness me. I mean, why did God create us like that? No. Well, why who's paid for, you know, who needs it? No. But so yeah, but we are stuck with it, isn't it? And we see we have some faith, and the Buddha said pain is obligatory, it's inevitable, but suffering is optional. It's not, it's and so there is something, there's some secret there, which we might not have quite cracked yet. But that it's certainly okay, we might have to feel pain, but the way that we respond to it, the way we relate to it, is something that we can examine, and then there we have some choice. We can change, and it might make a difference. And so we just take an interest in it. And then again, it's important, this thing, it's not just a cognitive interest, right? We remember consciousness is heart consciousness and mind consciousness. So it immediately that we have to remember that, otherwise it's not going to work. We need compassion. No, for ourselves. I mean, hopefully, you're not just going to wallow in self-pity. That's something different. But, you know, pain, you know, as others ourselves, we try to open our heart and say, well, yeah, this is painful. And maybe it's sad and I don't like it. And maybe I should be nice to myself to help myself to live with this better. You know, see what works, you know. And so, but in sometimes, you know, there are different kinds of pains. You know, sometimes you need to go to the doctor. You know, I'm certainly don't advertise to just, you know, grit your teeth and just push through everything to be a spiritual warrior. You know, as a, originally the meaning of pain for the bodies is trying to indicate to you that something wrong going on, isn't it? So you look after it. So you try what you can, and then you try to find the right balance. You know, that's, I mean, I know about that experience, is the painful experience of this thing, this people with chronic stuff, you know, at the beginning you have ideas and you go and you're hopeful, you find, oh yeah, you see this doctor or this healer and this and that, and then you try 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, by sometime you have tried 12 different things and still, you know, it kind of changes, but it doesn't go away. And so what do you do? Well, you learn to live with it, isn't it? What else are you going to do? But it's the heart quality that's the important thing. Like my first teacher, like you always said, we need to learn to be our own best friends. You know? And to question that, to think about what that means. Of course, it doesn't mean always to just have ice cream all the time, but it does mean not to be hard on ourselves. Sometimes we need to, you know, it's our best friend needs to be a bit strict as well, but we need to have also the other side. So it's not just pushing and just not just giving in, it's just being interested. allowing the pain to open your heart towards compassion, but also being interested, wanting to learn, and living the question, trying to find out for yourself what works. You know, and there's not, I don't have the answers, and you know, nobody has the kind of answers, but that means the pain becomes an investigation in a small way as well as in a big way. You know, like like if you do a meditation or retreat, it's inevitable that sooner or later there's always pain coming up, isn't it? Because the body is not really built to sit, you know, for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's a great opportunity really to just look at the mechanics of pain, to see, to really take an interest, you know, but with kindness in the heart. And then if you just trust in awareness itself and you really be aware, you also notice how these, the interest, even the means, if I say, if I start to take an interest, you know, with some kind attention, there's probably also a change in attitude from, let's say, just an aversion, a reaction. And that's going to have an effect. So be interested to see, oh, what is the effect? Oh, so I might have found something that's not going to heal everything and make the pain go away, but it might actually be helpful and say, oh, you know, it's a kind of kind-hearted curiosity. Usually, say, makes me feels better than just impatient aversion, you know. but yeah, then comes a moment when it doesn't work, but you know, so life always changes, but we just go with it. I mean, that's the bottom of all the secrets, and being willing to learn from everything. Well, and that's the basis. That's the basis of meditation. That's the basis of spiritual questioning. It's just to really be interested in our experience and to allow it to inform us and to try to learn from it. We know that we are imperfect. We know that we are not doing things right. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here. We'd be, but we'll be enlightened. You know, we'd be free of suffering. You know, we would, and it would be quite a different experience. But so we are still suffering. So we know we have work to do. How do we want to do this work? You know, we need to question ourselves. What is our image of ourselves as a practitioner? You know, am I just the samurai or the dutifully marching soldier, or am I don't know, am I my own best friend, and what does that mean? You know, or, you know, what are the qualities that I feel I need to develop in order to give myself enough nourishment on this journey in order to face those sometimes really, really harsh realities of life? As we know, I mean, we've got, some of us might have quite a lot of pain. We all know there are always other people right now who have to put up with a hell of more. You know, it's just how can human beings put up with that? You know? And we don't know what's going to come our way in the future, but we can be willing to experience and to want to open to it and to learn. That's the basic attitude. We've got the heart, we've got the cognitive, you know, the mental consciousness. Now we also think, well, maybe there are some, maybe there's a cure for this, you know, rather than me just sitting this all the time and, you know, looking at my back ache, you know, maybe I should just, you know, see a back doctor, or maybe I should just ask my friend and tell me, why am I actually sitting straight? you know, maybe it has something to do with my posture. Maybe I can, you know, maybe I can do something about it. If you can do something about it, then we should. No. Maybe just use discernment. We don't want to be overindulgent, just always give in to everything. But also don't want to be over idealistic in some form. It makes us inflexible. I think that's, you know, the way to do it. But we all have to find out for ourselves. So really the only thing that I can really recommend is just like with, and I think pain is just a very good example because it's so direct. For it's just genuine, heart-centered, spiritually motivated investigation into reality. Okay. Pain is reality. To just be willing to accept that. I mean, we all, you know, have awareness of some limitations that we have, but we might feel we compare unfavorably with others, things that we're struggling with. And everybody's got these kind of things. And we just really have to take this on consciously, kind of accept that as part of our reality. Don't just have aversion towards it. Don't reject it. That's just what I'm supposed to start. Don't just try to get rid of it. Just realize, well, that is part of myself and my reality, like the same as the bits that I do like. That's why I never had children, but like if your parents, you know, if you actually truly love your children, I mean, you accept the whole package. Sometimes your children are lovely and wonderful, and but sometimes it's just horror. But you cannot then just throw them on the dump because, I mean, that'd be very unfortunate. You know, you just realize, okay, I have taken this on. I love you anyway, and this is different. Sometimes you need tough love, maybe. You don't know, but it would be nice. But you know in your heart, basically, okay, this is my reality. I accept this. Well, then I'm willing to really fully opening up to this, and then I'm looking for kind and intelligent responses. And I look for resources. Maybe I find them in myself or not. I start to look around because I'm interested. I want things to get better. So I start to look. What or who might be able to help? And sooner or later, you might find something. If you're really searching, I mean, we find something. You know? So we might not get what we want because that's again, you know, so it's a projection of our mind. But we are alive. We use all of our experience as part of getting deeper into reality, understanding deeper. And understanding doesn't come according to our program or our wishes. But what we can do is we can invest in our investigation. And if that's sincere, that's where it has to come from. And it has to have heart. And it's not just intellectual. Then I think we have the right questions. And then we also find the right answers. Often they are not quick answers, isn't it? I mean, whether it's some emotional blockage, or even something like as I mentioned, like this chronic pain, isn't it? That usually there are no quick answers, but things do change. And if not the pain, sometimes our internal space with which we relate to this pain can change dramatically and absolutely surprisingly. And I mean, as probably all of us, I mean, you know that from people who had to deal with horrible pain. And yet, we're able to find happiness right within it. It is possible, but it doesn't come on some, you know, just by willing it or by simple, but by a genuine trying to find out what might work with this. It's not very satisfactory for the mind who wants a clear answer, but it's like the German poet, you know, Rainer Maria Rilke said, you know, we have to learn to list the questions. Maybe usually we are not having the answers yet because you're not ready, you're not mature. So what we can do is we can live sincerely our questions. Then sometime maybe, you know, the reality will give us the answers. Sometimes it's very direct or very simple, but sometimes it's just very subtle. When you're just trying and wondering, and you might never find. Sometimes it's like you might never find the answer, but in the process, in the journey, you just realize that your relationship, say, with the pain has changed, and suddenly it's not so much of a problem anymore because you just have much more space around it. I mean, sometimes it's something very simple, like somebody comes and says, "Well, you know, I meditate and I do, you know, whenever I meditate, you know, I'm always getting a headache." And then you ask also, "What do you do? Why do Anapanasati? And where do you observe your breath?" "Well, yeah, right here." And they look at you and talk, and you notice they're very, very intense. I mean, they're very tense. And as soon as they start down to meditate, they really want to get down to it. And yeah, as you say, I mean that. It might not, but for some people, of course, that straight away translates into tensions in the neck, and then you end up with a headache. So you say, well, simple answer, isn't it? Next, right? So they might not be able to actually switch it off very simply. That's a whole other thing. Well, how do you stop that kind of, because it's a whole program of a personality which eventually has to change, but it might not be actually happening very quickly, you know? But sometimes it's more like maybe if you throw a stone into a bucket of water, it makes a splash, and then you have to mop it up. Now, if you throw the same stone into a swimming pool, it kind of makes plop and makes some waves. It's the same stone, same weight, same physical reaction, everything. But because of the size of the container, the outcome is quite different. And that's something that, you know, practice meditation can also do, that you realize it's not actually a specific solution for a specific problem. It's just you realize with your continuous kind of practice of inquiry and cultivating those qualities of being present and developing patience, you just develop much more capacity. And the things that have bothered you before just don't bother you anymore in the same way, whether it's your neighbor or whether it's a pain in your knee. And then also, that's also one way of starting to find out that a lot of that, even the quality of the sensation, has a lot of that, not all of it maybe, but a lot of it has also to do with the way that we relate to it. You know, if I relax about it, it feels different. It might not go away, but it feels different. So, that's the kind of general encouragement, you know, I like to give, whatever the specific solutions that might come or might not come. But it's the qualities of the heart that we cultivate with it, with our inquiry, which are the most important thing. And that's the same, like with the space that we might develop to live with and relieve our inner, it's like speaking physical pain or our mental aches or something. It applies to everything. That's the same space which we maybe start to have more capacity to deal with the world, you know, wherever we perceive it as problematic, whether it's in our relationships or whether it's the news or, you know, what's going on, or the politicians or the neighbors or the, you know, or that poor thing, my body, you know, which has served me for so long, but, you know, it's always aching somewhere. There's no way out of it anyway. The way out is in.